don't accept any responsibility at all. Before we have our lecture tonight, I would like to just say a word about the Institute itself. As you know, the Institute has been going for some 60 years, and we go and we rely principally upon memberships. I understand that there's a feeling somewhere in Vancouver or in this audience, perhaps, that a membership in the Institute is a very exclusive affair. I assure you it's not exclusive at all. We welcome anybody at all to join the membership, and see one of the young ladies at the desk outside if you're interested, and we'd be glad to welcome you as members. Now, our guest speaker tonight, Professor Harold Edgerton, is a world-known figure in the field of electrical engineering, photography, strobe lights, underwater detection devices, what have you. In fact, it's been said to me that, and I've thought of this myself, that they all know who Professor Edgerton is, but who's that fellow who's trying to introduce him? Professor Edgerton tells me that he's been a failure at school. He went to MIT when he was a young man in the 20s, and he's never got out of there. He has carried on from being assistant professor to professor of electrical engineering till he's now professor emeritus, and he's still there. Some failure. In addition to the field of electrical engineering, he has many other sidelines, which have become headlines for him now. He's a pioneer in underwater camera development. He's done that for the National Geographic. He's worked with Jacques Cousteau, and he's worked with the operators of many bathyscopes. He's a fellow of many electronic and photographic societies. He's a member of numerous scientific associations. He's been awarded something like 30 gold medals for various awards. And he's a recipient of honorary degrees in several universities. Specifically, in underwater sea exploration, he has attained a great distinction with sound scanning equipment of his own design. I think and hope that his equipment is the successor to what we used to call in the Second World War, ASDIC. But he tells me that the American Navy won't tell him any more than the Canadian Navy will tell me as to what they're doing nowadays. He suspects not very much. And currently, Professor Edgerton is engaged in underwater archaeology in our own Gulf Islands. I think you've heard that he has carried on some experiments in Loch Ness, and we perhaps hear about the result of those tonight. His topic for us this evening is the use of electrical methods for underwater discovery, including the Loch Ness Monster. That's right. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, thank you very much for this introduction, members of the Institute. It's my great pleasure to talk to you about some of the things that are of great interest to me in the use of electrical engineering and things. I'm sure I'm not going to tell you very much, but I do hope to interest you in the stroboscope. I really should have called this lecture the magic light, the strobe light, because it's a thing that got me into all this trouble. When I first went to MIT, I was a real serious student, and I wanted to know everything about synchronous motors. And I lived motors, ate motors, dreamt motors, worked in motors for 3 years. And one of the things I used in that work was an instrument called a stroboscope. And one day somebody came in and said, why don't you use that fool thing for something else? And I said, well, what else is there? Synchronous motors. And And from then on, I've kind of forgotten what those motors are like, because it just seems one thing leads right after another. And the basic reason for all this is due to the fact that human beings lack the ability to see anything that happens quickly. If I was a magician, I would go like that and have a bouquet of flowers. I'm not a musician, magician. But you've all been fooled by things that happen quickly. And now I've got a little display here. I particularly want the younger people in the audience to come up and try it, because that water is running uphill. You can see it's just this water I brought down here from Cambridge, Massachusetts. It's not Toronto water. I mean Vancouver water. And it's if you don't like your water going up, there's some people that are conventional and don't like. Can we blow out the lights in the room a little bit? Is it possible to? Yeah, you push the right button there, will you? You couldn't leave a few of them on, but I'm an electrical engineer, but I'm not close to any switches. Now, those of you that like to explore the intricacies of drop formation and you don't like your water going up, you snap the finger once and it'll go down, see? And you do it twice, it'll go up if you turn the knob on this instrument the right direction. But the detail in this is very good, because the pump here is running 60 times a second from the electrical line, and the drops are coming out 60 times a second. And this proves, when you watch the drops down at the bottom, it's fascinating down here. It's too bad there isn't room for all of you to look in this pot and see these drops pick themselves up. Look at that. Isn't that great? See those things pick themselves up and pop off of there and go right up in there. If any of you would like to have one of these for a souvenir, well, there's one for you. Now, the strobe is really a magic instrument, and it's caused me all kinds of... We can leave the lights off, because I think you can still see me down here. I'm not going to do anything else but turn on some lights pretty quick. And at the end, if any of you would like to become a registered stroboscopist, come down and I'll let you run this. You have to learn to turn a knob and turn a switch. So it's anybody that can run a TV can run this machine. And what it does, it frees you of the inadequacy of your eyes to look at periodic things. Anything that happens periodically, if you can flash the light the same frequency as the thing. Those drops are coming out 60 times per second. If I put it exactly 60 times per second, it'll stand still. There's a button on here that says 60 cycles on it somewhere. And it'll stay there all night. It's really amazing to see those drops just sit there. But I like them to go up, don't you? Much more interesting to have it go up. Have them go up and go back into the faucet. Now, I may be joking about this machine and what it does, but it has found quite a few uses in engineering and science to stop things that are periodic move. And high-speed photography has found many applications of trying to find things with and without the help of photography, to slow down very rapid things so that it's possible to see them and to understand them. Once you can understand them, then you can start writing equations around them and trying to exploit them and using them for some purpose. Now, I have a collection of slides. I'm going to run right through those because I don't want to talk too long tonight here. And I want to turn this slide out. Suppose you turn that switch. I'm an electrical engineer, you can see, advantage of training. I push slide number forward, it says slide. There we are. Now the lights in the room, I push another switch. Or do I just say lights out? Lights out. There. Now this picture is typical to me of something that happens very quickly. That's a 30 caliber bullet going 2,800 feet per second. And it's just making applesauce out of that apple. I don't recommend this as a recipe. It's a little too fast.
But it does show that you can stop very rapid things by having a flash of light that lasts a short enough time so it'll stop the action. Now, the light in this little strobe display is actually about 3 microseconds long. The flash in that picture, it took the picture of that apple, is about 1/3 of a millionth of a second. So the bullet, although it's going very fast, is photographed sharp and clear without any blur. Forward, it says here. Now that's my double piddler machine. This one here is a single. But by having a double job where two drops come together and hit, you get this fantastic little disc. And if any of you come down to Boston and Stroh Valley where I hold forth, I invite you up to see this display. It's also over in the New England Aquarium and over in the Museum of Science. These drops, we're getting an awful lot of mileage out of these poor little drops. They do show that something that's common to you, like a drop that happens very quick. This is a golf ball photographed many years ago with a flash of light that lasted 10 millionths of a second. Now, quite often the serious problem in this type of work is how do you get the light to flash at the right time? And I think there's no secret about this picture. The two little wires on the far side were knocked together by the ball. The ball is hit on this side by a club going 150 feet per second. So that side of the ball is going 150 feet per second. The other side of the ball is standing still. Now something has to give. So the force that's required to squeeze this comes from the inertia in that thing. And if you want to know how much that force is, next time you get a hold of a golf ball, squeeze it so it's about 1/4 inch thinner than it is normally, and you'll know how much force that takes to squeeze that ball. Now then the ball jumps off of the club and springs towards the target and oscillates as it goes. That's an iron shot. I criticized it. I said, this is a little too low. You should have it a little higher. So he did it again. Now when a whip is cracked, it makes a noise that's due to the end of the whip going faster than the velocity of sound. So here's a series of pictures taken at 5,000 per second. It's 1/5,000 per second between those pictures, and it shows that tip as it flips over and it reaches a supersonic speed and makes that crack. Now, there are a lot of things that happen slowly, but you don't know when they're going to happen. So at one time, we built some tremendous big strobes, and I had them at the circus. And it shows you can take big subjects as well as little subjects. And there are a lot of interesting things in nature, like hummingbirds. You might guess this is not a ruby-throat hummingbird. This is an Arizona blue throat. There are about 600 species of hummingbirds. Several books have been written. The most interesting one to me is one by Crawford Greenwald, who lives in Wilmington. And while he was doing this very important ornithological photography of about 60 species of hummingbirds, which was published in a book by some New York museum entitled Hummingbirds, all the time he was doing this, on the side, he was the president of a company in Wilmington named the DuPont Company that you may have heard of. One of the students had this ancient revolver, and after he shot this, we developed the picture. He didn't want to shoot it any again the second time. And now we're about to go underwater. I've spent an awful lot of time underwater. I don't know how I got started underwater. It's probably because I read about Captain Nemo from Jules Verne when I was a boy, because I always think about submarines. Now, in the background, there is a submarine there called the FNRS-3, the Trieste, which are built over in France, one of them by Picard and by the French Navy, and they have the capability of going to 14,000 feet. The first time I heard or saw one of these things, when I was aboard the Calypso in Toulon Harbor in 1954, we pulled in there in the evening, and Cousteau said, I want to show you something. And we went over to the side of the dock and we looked at this little thing in the water. And he says, that's a submarine good for 14,000 feet. Well, now I'm an engineer and I know that you can't make a submarine that'll go 14,000 feet and come back up to the surface with its own buoyancy. The materials are not strong enough. And that's very important to the people that are inside of that submarine. So I says, Cousteau, you must have got mixed up with meters and feet or something, because there are no submarines that go to 14,000 feet. Well, he showed that I was wrong, and he showed me how this machine works. It has a big tank of gasoline on top of the sphere. The sphere will not come back by itself, because the walls have to be thick enough to withstand the pressure. And so Dr. Picard, August Picard, was the fellow who invented this machine. And I said, how did he happen to do that? He said, well, Picard was actually a balloonist, and he was the first man to go to 50,000 feet high in a balloon. And at that height, you have to have oxygen and a closed system and absorb the CO2 to stay alive. And he went up in the balloon from somewhere in Belgium, and they landed up in the Alps Mountains. And his wife took a very dim view of this whole operation. He was up there on that glacier for a couple of days. He finally got home, and she had the rolling pin out, and he said, I promise never to go up in a balloon again. And all the time he was coming back from Switzerland, he was drawing sketches of this submarine. Now here's a young man. A person is extremely vulnerable in the water. He has an electronic flash unit of the type that we use for taking all these pictures. The reason you use it underwater is not because of speed, because of the ability to get pictures, a lot of pictures under the water. Now that unit is capable of going down 200 or 300 feet and photographing things that, and the reason you have to have the lamp on a camera is because water absorbs the light. So once you get further than 15 or 20 or 30 feet away, the light is absorbed and the colors are lost. And in fact, quite often you can't get pictures. Like in the Charles River, we seldom go more than a few feet when we're lost. So this is another use of strobe light other than speed. It's developed for speed and it's used in all kinds of engineering and applications and scientific applications, but it's also used for making pictures underwater. It's been very exciting to me because so much of the world is covered by water and you'd like to know what it is. So instead of going down in these diving machines, which takes a lot of time and trouble and effort, as anybody can tell you who's ever tried it, by just putting a camera, there are two cameras up at the top and there's a strobe light at the bottom, and in the middle is a thing called a pinger. I got into sound backwards by needing it to tell where this camera was. Because the problem is, how do you stop the camera when it's a certain distance off the bottom, like 20 feet? If you get it too deep, it'll go into the mud. If it's too high, you won't get any pictures. So when you drop the camera down, it might be 7 miles deep at the deepest place, and you have to hold it within probably 5 feet. And it seems impossible because the windage and the currents and everything. So by putting a pinger on there, which goes ping, 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 and it sends one signal directly to the surface, another one goes down to the bottom, hits the bottom, and then goes back up the surface. You get click, click, and measuring the time between them and a little arithmetic, you can tell exactly where that camera is. And it's been an almost miraculous thing to help deep sea photography. There's a tremendous amount of the earth covered with water, and it's very, very deep. The average oceans are about 2 or 3 miles deep, and it takes a lot of photographs to do that. I was asked by a Russian if I would be a guest on one of his ships in the Atlantic, and I said, of course not, unless you go where I want to go and do what I want to do. And I thought that'd be the end of that, because I knew he worked in the Pacific. Well, he said, where do you want to go? And I said, well, I want to go out the Rift Valley, halfway between here and Africa, and take some pictures in that crack. Well, he said, okay, let's go. And I was stuck. So here I went and I took two MIT students, freshmen, on this Russian ship, and we had a wonderful time to have this great big ship at our control whenever they'd give it to us. This is the camera. It was down four times about 3.5 miles to get some of these pictures at the bottom. Then the sonar is the next thing that's of interest. This is Peter Throckmorton, who I worked with in Greece many, many times, who's written several books. If you're interested in these books, right now he's in the Falkland Islands looking for wrecks. And we use this sonar, which has a side scan. We were using this about 3 hours ago out in that bay out here with these islands looking for some kind of a ship. And we found an awful lot of geology out there. But the ship, if there is one there, is still concealed. I haven't really got time to tell you everything I know about this. It really wouldn't take it long. But this sends out a parallel beam out both sides. That black thing in the side, this is what's called a side scan sonar. And you drag this along behind a ship, and it's almost like a miracle to have it draw pictures of what's on the bottom. Now, if this ship that they lost out here in these islands had been on a nice flat place with nothing but mud, it would look like this. That's a ship. Now, that was taken. That was a ship that was sunk in World War II in the Bay of Patras. And you can see the people that dropped bombs on it weren't very accurate, because there's 3 bomb holes over here, 4 bomb holes, 5 bomb holes where they missed it. And the reason that thing has got 4 masts, it's only got one, is due to the fact it was a very rough day, and my sonar was going like this, and it printed the mast 4 times. So this is a marvelous technique, because you can find things that are underwater. And a year ago, I was on the Calypso in the Bay of Patras, and we went over to see this thing, and we were going to make a dive on it. It's about 200 feet deep. But we had a beautiful storm that night. Everybody was seasick. We tried to go crossways in the waves, and the Calypso practically rolled over. And that night, the ferry didn't go to Italy. It was so bad. So I've got to go back again. One thing, we as humans, we really ought to do something about the weather. Because whenever you go out on an archaeological expedition, you almost always hit a bad day. Today, all it did was sprinkle a little. But the ocean out there was flat as this table. And I want to compliment you Canadians on having such a beautiful, nice, flat ocean. Several years ago, I went down to try to find the Monitor, which was a Civil War ship that was sunk in 1862. And it's 16 miles offshore. We finally found the thing. There are lots of people who looked for it. And here it is with its turret, as seen by a sonar. It's 220 feet deep. No divers have been on it yet. We almost had an expedition to get back a camera that was lost on it, but we haven't done it yet. But we did take some pictures down there with a big ship called the Alcoa Sea Probe. And this is all written up in a magazine that's published in the USA. Got a yellow cover. It's about that square. And what are you laughing at? It's a very nice magazine. It's full of pictures. And it's got all kinds of things. You'll find in January, about a year ago, this article about the struggle we had to find this thing. And then we got the Alcoa Sea Probe, which is a marvelous ship with a thing hanging down in the middle, which took overlapping pictures, 2,000 pictures. And the U.S. Navy glued these all together, and there's the bottom of that ship. We didn't know it was the bottom at first because it's such bad shape. But that ship is actually upside down, and the turret fell off. And then the ship came down on top of the turret. And over at the right-hand side is the boiler. And this is the cruise quarters. And where the black line comes down shows where a camera was that belonged to Duke University that I borrowed. And I haven't been able to return it. And it's got some of the best pictures made of the monitor are in that camera. The negatives are still in there. And I've been down there 3 times now trying to get a hook on that because I want to get that camera back. I want those pictures, and give me time. We almost made it in August, but there was some complications in Washington. In case, I don't know whether your government has problems like that or not, but we had a few complications with the government. Now, this is a Cousteau sous-coupe. And if you have to learn a little French to write on the Calypso. Sous-coupe means saucer. It's supposed to be a diving saucer. And of course it's equipped with sonar, and of course it's equipped with cameras. And I've had several very interesting rides in this machine. He's got a crane so he lifts it right off and puts it in the water. He also has a helicopter on there, so if you aren't, you can't see enough down below, you can take a helicopter and go up above. It's a marvelous thing to work with Cousteau because he's imaginative, and he can move on a moment's notice and go anywhere except into outer space. Now, this is one of those things that go around the Earth, and it's got, of course, it's got strobe lights on it. Those little doors on either side are strobe lights, and when they want to make a rendezvous with another thing, they blink these lights. So they, when you're out in outer space, everything is black except stars. You look for a star that blinks, and it blinks like that light does over there. You wiggle your head back and forth, and when you see a blinking light, aim for it, because that's the thing you want to rendezvous with. So it's very, it sounds very simple. In the war, we made some great big units for taking pictures. We used to go and take pictures of the Germans and the Japanese when we were unfriendly to them. Now they seem to be, or the other, friendly. But this, when the war was over, I borrowed one of these from the Air Force. They were going to, I don't know what they were going to do with it, but I wrote the Air, Air Force, Washington, D.C. Dear sir, we spent a lot of time making these great big units for you during the war, and I recommend you give one of those to MIT for educational purposes. And sure enough, about 6 months later, a fellow called me from the airport and says, this is Lieutenant Smith. And I said, so what? He says, you better get over here with a truck. I got a whole bunch of junk for you. And they gave me about 3 tons of these great big capacitors and strobe lights that were used in the war. The war is over and they didn't need them anymore. So here's a picture of MIT taken with a strobe light from a mile high. And there were a lot of reports by people, especially in Back Bay, of very unusual atmospheric conditions that night. Now we're ready to go underwater. Now this camera is the one that took the pictures of Loch Ness animal. I don't know whether it's a monster or not, but this camera has caused us a lot of trouble. This camera was actually built with a grant from the National Geographic Society to study the flow of sediments in the Boston Harbor. How the tides go in and out and they move the sand and the mud. And the way in which this camera operates is the diver takes it down to the bottom, sets it on the bottom, leaves it for 12 hours. And it takes a picture every 20 or 30 seconds on a movie film, and then you see what happens. Now, I made a mistake of taking this out. The first time I took it out to a place where there was nothing but this seaweed, this great big long seaweeds. And they'd had a storm, and these seaweeds were all broken loose. So the first time the tide came in, it put a seaweed right, pong, right across the lens. And it's 6 hours later, the tide went out and it took the thing away and I could see four or five more pictures till another seaweed came around the other way. And then a few more pictures and another one the other way. And it was, but in between, there was a few pictures that showed starfish and wandering around on the bottom. Now starfish, every time I go swimming, sit there and don't do anything. But on this picture, they were moving, because I'm speeding them up by a factor of 400. So they now look human. They have desires. They go places. They do things. And so this fellow, Ken Reed, he's over at BU, and a very good friend of mine. He's interested in biology, and he's one of the world's experts in sand dollars. So I said, I'll loan you the camera. You can take it out to Hodgkin's Cove and take some pictures of sand dollars. So here he is getting ready to go out there. And this next picture shows the setup. And now we're going to turn this off and go to the movie. Bear with me. First I push the, what's this say? Super? Forward, reverse. There's no stop on this, is it? Does that mean stop? Oh yeah, there it is. Now push the movie. Thanks a lot. Here we go. Now this movie was made of that particular unit. Maybe close that door, it's a little bit light in here. This movie is 16 millimeter elapsed time, so the first few scenes that you'll see in it are speeded up by a factor of about 4 to show you what human beings look like when they're speeded up by 4. So when this comes on, you'll see the front door of MIT. Film. Does that go? Oh, that's slide.
No, press the slide again.
This one.
Okay. Where's the movie?
Here we are. This is MIT, the main door in 77 Mass Avenue. And if we could make the students learn as fast as this, we could get them to in 1 year instead of four. But we've given up on that because there's a few slight problems. Now, what's the traffic when it starts up? Now, we're going to do this in the ocean, except instead of four times, we're going to go 400 times because things in the ocean happen so slowly. So this is my mobile oceanographic equipment. And we're sneaking up on the ocean. Unfortunately, I had my grandson along that day to supervise. Otherwise, we'd probably had some problems. And I said, Ken, when you come back, be sure to bring some of those sand dollars back, because I'm sure Eric doesn't know about those. And besides, I want to see him too. So here he goes. That float is he keeps the thing floating. Now he's planted it on the bottom. He's turned on the batteries. It takes a picture every 25 seconds. And now he's come back Ken, did you bring those sand dollars back? You better. I don't see them. Where are they? Well, he hid them up his sleeve. That's generally where they put the gold coins when they find them. They hide them up the sleeves. So there's the sand dollars. They got little feet on the bottom, and they walk around in the sand. In this picture, you'll see a very interesting small red starfish way up the top. He just barely comes in, then he goes out, but he'll be in back again in a minute. Here he comes. Watch that. Isn't he a beauty? A red starfish with white tips. So this is a lapse time movie. Now, this equipment was... This equipment was given when a fellow named Rhines came in to see me. I'll push the slides again. That one. Okay, there we come. So that's the equipment we used for photographing that. He wanted to photograph animals in Loch Ness. Well, I said, there ain't no animals in Loch Ness. I've been around long enough to know it's just a... nobody sees anything in there unless they've been in three pubs. So, but I said, I'll tell you what I'll do. This Bob Rhines was an old friend of mine. I'd known him ever since he was a boy. And we'd been to Israel a couple times on archaeological expeditions. And I could see he was so serious about it. I said, I will loan you this lapse time camera, because when I work in the ocean, I know that you're going to lose one equipment right away. So I always make three. I make one to lose in the ocean, one to take the pictures, and the third one for parts and pieces to back up the second one. So I was very lucky in working out in Boston Harbor, because we always had a line hooked onto it, so we never lost anything. So I had an extra camera given to me by Funds from Geographic. So I thought, I'll loan you this equipment if you'll be sure to let me know what you get. I mean, I want facts. I don't want any fiction of that. So he went over in the first summer. He had it in the mud. The second summer, he had it too high. The third summer, he started to get some results. Here's Bob Rhines over at the right, and Charlie Wyckoff had worked together as a team, working in this beautiful lake or loch over in Scotland. It's 22 miles long and about 2 miles wide, 900 feet deep. And it has occasional sightings of these animals. Here's the first picture that came out of that camera about after he'd had it about 2 or 3 years. It's the famous fin picture. This picture shows that something looks like a fin. It's about 3 feet long, and it really got us all excited. And then in last year, a year and a half ago. I've been working on this problem so long I can't even remember whether it was last week or 10 years ago. But this picture is a very interesting one. I would say this is about the worst picture I have ever seen. But gosh, it's exciting. It's really exciting. It's because it's out on the periphery. And this apparently is a hard problem. It isn't an easy problem like going to the moon or Mars or somewhere else. You know, this is a tough problem of trying to get this darn thing to pose. Well, the thing that got me excited about it was apparently something grabbed a hold of the camera and swung it around and hit it with its fins and aimed it up. So I spent 2 months over there last summer, and there was four or five of us, and we worked all summer, day and night, and we got 100,000 pictures. Now, I exaggerate a little bit, because it actually was only 95,000 pictures, but 100,000 is a good round number, and it really doesn't make much difference to 5,000 more pictures, because they were all the same with nothing on all any of them. But this picture was taken a year before, and it nobody knows really what it is. But so your guess is as good as mine. Now, I don't believe in speculation and fantasy, and so I got to have more results. Now, that lake is very interesting. It's a beautiful place, and I hope you'll go up there sometime. It's a little crack over on the left-hand side, 22 miles long, and it's a great place. There's this is taken from a town named Vroom the Drocket. And that's Uquart Castle up there, and our castle place is right down at the bottom. And over in this little draw that goes on over at the right-hand side, there are two little rivers where the salmon spawn. But they're having a drought over there so that those two rivers are dry this year, and conditions are completely different, and we didn't see any animals. This is one of our boats, which we used to take pictures from. We did sonar all over the place, and we had quite a group. And in, some people would say our effort over there was a complete failure. That's our caravan on that dock. And there's Bob Rhines, who'd been planning one of the cameras on another boat. That's the little wire coming out the window is the one that goes to a sonar that looks at the camera. So there's the camera on the bow. There's Bob ready to hang it on the bow. This is the same place where we got those fin pictures. And we thought that the camera, in its flashing, would bring the animals to it. Something brought the animals to the camera. This was shot me down as an expert because I told Bob that never in my experience of years and years of taking pictures underwater, I found anything that came to the camera. They always go away from the camera. So I went over to prove that I was right. So this summer was a tremendous success for me. I don't believe everything I tell you. Actually, we built a big unit in the back to look at our lab's time camera. And after we didn't get anything for it, I set up a sonar. This is exactly the same equipment I had 4 hours, 5 hours ago over there looking for that wreck. It was raining out here, it was drizzling, but that is a sonar that's looking at the camera. And it showed that animals were coming about 100 meters away. But they're a long ways away. So we decided to build a barge. And here's Cleopatra's barge. On the other end is the lapsed time camera that took the pictures. On this end is a great big rig with a television and a great big strobe and a push-button control. And so you can sit back in that caravan. And when you see the monster, boing, you push the button. Here's some more of that equipment. We were really loaded with equipment over there. And we had some observers come by every day. They knew when we were having lunch. Notice how they keep those little 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Now, how many are there in this picture? Two of them are riding on the mama's back. They were very cute. They came around every day, and the papa and mama keep the little ones between them and don't stand for any monkey business from any of us Yankee visitors over there in Scotland. This is a young English student, Tomlinson, that helped us with side scan sonar, and he and a group, two Americans named Klein and Finkelstein, went up working with Professor McGowan. They were looking for bones on the bottom, hoping the sonar would show it. Here's Bob Rhines and his wife. That's what's called a slave labor, watching that sonar as it's grinding out information on what's in the water, because sonar is capable of going 200 meters, where the camera can only photograph about 10. So, and here's McGowan on the left, and Scott Sir Scott on the right, who's taken a tremendous, he's the son of the famous explorer. And that little gob they see in there, there were a lot of Boy Scouts came that day, and you can see there's something in between. And everybody got so excited until we looked out and saw a motorboat going through the area. You have to be sure when you're a scientist that you don't have some artifact that's unreal. But there's Mrs. Charlie Wyckoff up there at the left, who at 12:05 midnight saw this fantastic signal come in, stay there for about a minute and a half, and then go away. And here it is, turned right side up. The line right in the middle of the frame is the echo from a camera, and it's 200 meters out to the top part of the thing, and it comes in fast, it stays there, it goes away fast, it stops a little bit on the way. So you know it's not peat moss or something else, it's something dynamic that came into that distance, turned around, made its way, but it's nowhere near enough for our cameras to reach. And here's another one, a fantastic big signal. You could actually see a fish scooting away at the upper right-hand corner. Now, the trouble with sonar, it doesn't tell you everything. And I don't know whether these were caused by Russian submarines in this lake or water nymphs or water buffalo or what. But when anybody asks me, do I believe or not believe, I say, well, this isn't like religion. It isn't a matter of belief. I've got to have something more tangible. And I know there's something big in that lake because I get these sonar echoes, but I don't know what they are. But we got to keep working on it. This is the way we look after we've been looking at that sonar for about 4 hours. That's my friend McGowan. He got so interested in those bones. They went all over this lake with side scan sonar looking at the bottom. And it was a complete failure, but they brought some pictures in made by Finkelstein, and they had circles on them. There's Finkelstein pointing to the circle. And he says, what's that? And I said, hey, you found something. That's a prehistoric stone circle. We better get the divers down in there. And there's another one. There's another one. There's another one. And here's Klein. They're both of them. Looking at those circles. So this is what I love about this kind of work. When you go in the ocean to find a monster, you don't find a monster, but you find a whole bunch of prehistoric stone circles that are buried under the water. There's a big one that's almost as big as Stone Age. It's over in the north end of the place, and there's an expedition trying to be cooked up this summer. There's one on land. They're much easier to study on land. But you want to remember that they've been there for thousands of years, and all the farmers that need stones for their foundation for their barns come over there, and the Vikings came in there and took all the gold and silver and everything else. And all these stone circles in England, France, and Scotland and Ireland have all been worked over by people looking for treasure. So it's hopeful that maybe we've found some circles that haven't been molested, and we'll have some information about our ancestors who lived down there in the bottom. These are the clavis circles, which are quite near. Large stones put in a circle, and there's some burial tombs that are great deal like the burial tombs in Greece, where there's a tomb in the center of this tremendous pile of stones. So I'm very excited about the archaeological findings, because they may be more important than this monster business. I think we're moving over to the other slide projector now. I'll push it. It says forward. No, push this one. It says forward. I need help. Oh, I didn't go far enough. I was pushing the movie again. I'm glad I don't have to look at that movie again. I'm tired of that. Oh, here's some more of those circles. Aren't those marvelous? There's circles all over the place. This is in the north end, and they're about 35 feet deep. And there's a map. They're up at the top, way up at the top. This lake is 22 feet long. There's one big one down there near that town of Doors. And Urquhart, castle is down on the left-hand side where those two rivers are. It's where the fin picture was taken when the salmon were coming up there to spawn. So this area, is going to be a lot more research done in this area, serious research, because it needs to be done. And just because people say you have to be drunk to work up there, that's not so. There's a lot of things in that lake. So this is a typical thing that I like to point out. You go out to find one thing, and you find something else. That's what I call interesting. We saw him on the sonar, and he went by, and then this fisherman caught him, and we felt real bad about it. Because there were one of the locks, the gates is broken, and there are not too many salmon coming in. But I'm sure that'll be... we were over there on July 4th, and so we had to celebrate a little bit, so we didn't tell anybody, but there's an American flag up on the top, and Marty Klein is acting like a Pfeiffer in that famous painting we have of a fellow that's holding a flag, and Mrs. Rhines has got some ketchup on a handkerchief around her head and beating on a drum, and we all sang Yankee Doodle real quick until that dog came along, and he said, "Nothing doing. You, this is Scotland. You damn Yankees, go home." Now, if you ever go over there and you look out on this lake at Newport Castle, and if you see some bumps sticking up from the lake with a head sticking out, why, be sure to get a good picture of it and let me know, because that's where we were. Where we were. Now, I can't attest to the accuracy of this drawing, but it's issued by the Ministry for Monstrous Affairs over there in Scotland. And I saw a lot of things go on in Scotland that make you laugh. But you know that fellow with the net over there? Now, he isn't supposed to do that. You're not supposed to catch the monster. And that lady is not supposed to feed the monster. But the kid behind her, he's the only one that's seeing what's going on. And you notice how he's reacting. Well, I didn't see anything like this. And maybe they aren't there. But I have seen things that look like monsters with my sonar. Isn't that a beauty? That was taken down at Cape Hatteras, and that's a wake from a small motorboat. Isn't that a beauty? That was taken on the Calypso at Cape Artemision, where that large statue of Zeus was found. And it's another motorboat that was a little bit dizzy going back and forth there. But look at that. Isn't that beautiful? It's even better than that false picture. Well, I've looked for a lot of ships, and sometimes I find them and don't know it. This is one of them that I found, and then I wasn't sure about. This is over in Tobermory Bay in Scotland, where a Spanish galleon came in at the end of during the Armada, and it left this dock and blew up. There's a long story about it, and it's well documented, except the name of the ship. The historians didn't write down the name of that Spanish ship, but the ship blew up at one stone's throw from this dock. So while we were out there working with the sonar, one stone's throw from this dock, the King George steamship came in there every day and turned around, so we had to be sure to get out of the way of King George. So we worked with sonar over there. We were working for the Duke of Argyll. I was a fief of the Duke of Argyll for about 2 weeks. He's now deceased. But he's a very interesting man who was the head of the Campbell clan in Scotland. And this is one of the cannons that came off that ship many years ago, and they were trying to find it. So we were working for him on this expedition. And I'd like to show you what some of these poor things show, but they do show the bottom. Now, this has been dredged for many, many years by people with clamshells picking up things off the bottom. And you can see below where they stopped, there's some signals that come in from sound that goes to the bottom, through the bottom, and gives you those signals. So my advice to the Duke was, dig deeper, Duke. And there's a group over there now. His son is working in this area, and I don't know what he's doing, but I'm sure they're going to try to find the keel and that Spanish ship is probably down there, covered with the sediments in the bottom of that place. This is Sidney Wignall on the left-hand side, an English archaeologist, a very serious one. And Dr. T. Hall of Oxford, who's working on magnetometers, world's expert on magnetometers. And you can see they've had a hard afternoon. They found that the geology down there gave them so many magnetometer readings that it was discouraging. But we did find some, we were looking for, this is in Portobello in Panama. And that island over in the background is called Drake's Island. And it's well documented that Drake died of dysentery while he was in this area late in his life. And according to the records, he was put into a lead casket and thrown overboard. So we tried real hard to see if we could get a signal from that area. You can see there are a lot of signals. These are other islands that didn't quite come out of the water. And there are a lot of small things around there. We found some anchors, some real old anchors. And there's like a little dots here and there. All these still have to be investigated. There's a map showing some of the targets. But there were a lot of operational problems on this thing, and they didn't. It hasn't been finished yet. Most of these expeditions I go on, it takes too long. They're too hard to find. Just like we worked all day today looking for the ship, and all we found was a whole lot of ridges of rocks. And behind or in some of those ridges of rocks might be our target. So this is a wonderful way to do it. The Drake's lead casket with these remains in it, which they hope to take to Westminster Abbey, are probably still down there. Nobody knows. It's completely unknown. Now, one of the most interesting parts of this sonar is the use of what we call a penetration sonar. This is down in Puerto Rico. And there was a report that Drake sunk one of their ships down there in the old harbor. And there is a large target. And if anybody wants to know where it is, I can tell you exactly. I'm planning to publish this picture. The little shallow targets, we know, are no good because they investigated all them. And most of the shallow targets, like this one up here, consist mainly of ashes. There were a lot of steamboats in the 1880s, 90s, and they threw their ashes all overboard, and they went down in the mud, and they give you a beautiful sonar record about 3 feet under the mud. But here's this great big signal. It's about 5 meters deep, and I would dearly love to see somebody go to the work of digging that up and find out what it is. This is the way, with all of our research work, we almost always end up with more questions than we answer. So this is a kind of a disappointment in a way to find it. This is Bob Marks, who was working in Jamaica. And there's the sonar record of that Port Royal, which was a fantastic thing where a city disappeared one night. Look at all the bottles he's found. We worked for a week, early morning to late at night. We got a big stack of paper of all the areas with different places for him to dig. The reason they're trying to dig it up is because they're going to put a large port there for boats, and they're going to dig up this whole archaeological area. When I left, he had 10,000 clay pipes, all classified into different types, sizes, shapes, and dimensions he dug out of that thing. He's showing my wife these pipes. So, very important research. And I think this is my last slide, maybe it didn't. This is down in a little lake in Yucatan, where the Indians had a fantastic castle down there, temple, and a small canal that went out into the ocean, and it was all done with canoes. And I was working with Nancy Ferris, the University of Pennsylvania, in this little boat. There's my little sonar. We got some interesting results. But, of course, no canoes. Just to get you back into the high-speed photography field, it's possible to take pictures with so-called Schlieren photography of things that, like gas. This is a flame coming out of a candle after a bullet has passed through it, showing some of the turbulence. I think it's just a beautiful picture. And this is an electric fan
blowing hot air from a candle by backlighting it and putting different colors into behind some filters. This was described in Scientific American about a year and a half ago by one of my students, and if you're interested, I hope you'll follow it up. And my latest thing I was just doing last week is taking pictures of bugs without a lens, greatly magnified. And the thing is, goes back to Fox Talbot, an Englishman, who was the first one to take negative and positive pictures. He took a leaf and put it on a piece of paper with silver chloride on it, and the sun would shine over about 2 hours, and he took the leaf off, and he could see the pattern. And it was reversed in black and white, so he used that as a negative. He was the one that invented the negative-positive process. Now, the whole idea here is to get real fine-grained film and get some water with microbes or bugs in it, and put them on the film, and then flash a little tiny strobe light way up high so that you get a real good shadow. And I've got some of these pictures, one of them here, of a bug. There's some copepods and some other things. These were made in a pond. Those little squares over there show you the originals, and these are enlarged about 30 times. This is a very interesting thing to me. That's on its side, but if you don't want to get the film wet, then you put some very thin plastic film on a ring and put the thing on there. So there's a whole bunch of little bugs. One of them is the one that I have enlarged here, which shows you how they are. There's a copepod made in the Boston Harbor, and people said there's nothing alive in this harbor. And lo and behold, I found copepods and some little animals with feet wiggling around. That's a copepod, and you can see him at the end of that pencil. So the world, this is the advantage, is you can get a great big tray, put a big film on it, and cover the whole thing with a great big sample and get a great big strobe light up, and you shoot the whole works once. And it's an entirely different system than chasing one little bug around with a microscope. Then your trouble comes when you want to enlarge it. But that's, I'm not telling you about the troubles there. If you're going to work in this, you'll find those out yourself without me doing anything. This picture, there's always something turns up that's beautiful. This picture was Cambridge drinking water, and I put it in this my little machine and took a picture of it. And there are some little dots in the background. See those little black things? Now, those are the normal microbes that we normal drink every day, and we're used to them. We consume them by the ton. But look at this great big thing. That's almost a tenth of an inch long, and it's glowing. And I almost jumped right out, and I didn't take a drink for 2 days after I took that picture. But actually, it's a fraud, because this was caused by a small hair, probably a filament that came out of my clothing. It lit on the water. Where it touches the water, it depresses it. It makes like a lens. So it gives you a black thing, and the light that wasn't a black goes around the edge. So it's beautiful, and I'm going to try to exploit it some way. I don't know how, but isn't that a wonderful thing? It has nothing to do with my original objective, which was to take pictures of those little drops in the water. And my last picture I want to just show you, this is my favorite picture. It's taken many, many times, many, many years ago. It's a drop of milk splashing on a plate, photographed in a short time at the moment that the splash occurs. Now, if you do try to do this at home, the first splash only makes a little circle. The second one takes drop hitting exactly the same place, forces the liquid out the outside, and makes this splash. Now, every once in a while, students come around to me and said, there isn't anything left to done. You've taken pictures of the football and the golf ball and the tennis ball and all those. There's nothing left to do. I always take this picture out and say, you see that picture? That's the second. If you look at that real close, look at that great big thick neck on that one over on the right-hand side. And over on the left-hand side is one of them jumped off. I want all those little drops held on with just one little filament. And they go out in the lab, and you never get two drops alike, and it's awful hard to get one better than this. So I still keep working on it. If any of you want to work on this problem, you're welcome. And let me know how you come out, because I want to see a perfect spike someday and somewhere. Now, how to get the lights? Push the switch here. Lights. Thank you.
I've explained to Mr. Etherington that we have a policy of asking questions, and he said he'd be quite happy to answer them. Please make your questions, real questions, short and fair. Yes.
He was commenting about the world's worst picture, that grainy, very grainy picture. That was the man that made that was Charlie Wyckoff with this strobe light. And he thinks it's made between 20 and 25 feet away. And he had to really work on that negative to get it out, to get the print up. And some people think it's a body with a fin sticking out of it and a long neck and a head. Now, I like to see better pictures. I don't like to be having poor pictures. See, I didn't take that picture. But that's the kind we were trying to get this year. And except we had a 35-millimeter camera. We had two of them taken in stereo, and we had a much bigger strobe, and we moved the strobe further towards the subject. The philosophy of this whole summer was the elapsed time picture. The camera did get pictures. Not too many, but did get pictures. So this year was to use it as bait and have another camera with a TV, and you sit and watch this television. Boy, did I get tired looking at nothing. I'm an active type. And we had an awful hard time getting the people to come in from midnight to 6 in the morning, sit there and watch that stupid TV with nothing on it. So I'm not going to get involved in anything. I'm going to be smart enough to get out of that. The bottom knocked out of it, which somebody thought was modern, but finally they did concede it was Roman. Now, the second thing he was going to do was to go to Santorini, but he didn't say to find Atlantis. He said he was going to explore the myth of Atlantis. Now, there's lots of discussion about the theory I subscribe to is the one proposed by Professor Galanopoulos. Have you read his book? Professor Galanopoulos is a geology professor in Athens who has several interesting theories about Atlantis, and he thinks Atlantis was at Santorini. You're asking about the triangle down in the Bermuda Triangle. Mm-hmm. Well, we have one up in Boston, too. We have a triangle up there. I've got a whole bunch of ships I can't find in Boston. And, some with friends of mine on, yeah. And, in fact, I was out last 2 weeks ago. There was one down at Westport. A small fishing ship went down in a storm. And a lot of the parts have washed ashore. It's just like this place we're today, rocks all over the place. And the sonar is terribly helpless because these rocks may conceal wreckage. When the wreckage down there and bangs around in the storms, it's knocked apart. So we have to work with divers. We have to say, try here, try there, try there. So I don't know anything about that triangle, but I've been out there. And we came through there in that big Russian ship, right through that whole area. And I looked all over it. We didn't have any trouble. We're still here. Yeah, a lot of those are, I think, I always like to work with facts. And there are lots of airplanes and ships lost everywhere. Down at Cape Hatteras was fantastic. When we first started to work on that monitor, we had a map with 600 wrecks on it in North Carolina. And we were out 2 weeks, we found two wrecks. One was an old fishing ship 300 feet deep, and we found a monitor. And neither of them were on this map. So I don't know how many more there are. It's a good place to have a wreck down there.
Professor Edgerton, You know, your sonar has a range of several hundred meters, and right. This damn lake is only 2 miles wide. Why don't you take a bank of several dozen of the sonar devices and answer the question once and for all, and sweep the lake?
Well, we got a production department here. Well, I'm a retired professor. I'm not supposed to do anything anymore. And I got stuck on this summer working 2 months, 12 hours a night, and more than that. I had a letter from five high school kids down in New Jersey. No, they were junior high, complete with drawings of they were going to put a net, drag it through the whole lake, and then at the end they were going to have helicopters with slurp guns and ammunition things and shoot these things and get them to sleep, drag them up the shore and measure them, and put them back in the lake. Now they were all set. So I wrote them, I says, hurry up, grow up, kids. looks like there's going to be plenty of opportunities. I'm sure I won't finish this job for you.
Who? The Hughes Glomar was really looking for.
Hughes Glomar, they were looking for a Russian submarine.
Really?
Well, that's what I read in the papers. Do you know more about it than that?
Thought you might.
No, I don't know anything about it. All I was reading the paper, but we were working with peanuts on this monitor thing, and all free labor, everybody paying their own way and all that kind of stuff, and a small grant to Geographic to pay for films and transportation. Then I hear about these great big things where they spend millions. And I thought, hey, we're in the wrong racket. But we like it the way it is, because we're out in the open and we have a lot of fun at it and everybody's working. It's the cooperation on the monitor thing was fantastic. Everybody helped and got interested, and it was kind of discouraging at times, but it was a lot of fun. I like good, tough problems. Now, we got a real tough one today. We worked all day and we didn't get anything. Well, we got a million rocks out there. But you don't need them. Well, there's some ship that went down with a bunch of rocks on it. They were going to take them down to California to make Capitol building down there in 1870 or something. It was a ship, and it got in a storm and ran into an island out there, one of those islands, and sunk. The men got off, and the ship went down. For a while, the mast stuck out. They should have put a X on the map, but they didn't. So now the ships would shake apart, and they disintegrate. And every storm comes in and beats them up some more. So pretty soon, there's nothing left. It's very discouraging. Sometimes you find practically nothing. Like that famous ship that went down to, a friend of mine went down from the Geographic and he found just a few nails left in the sand. Things disappear.
Well, now what sort of depth is it in, this one close by here?
Well, we were going out to about 60, 80 feet, something like that. But there's a bunch of ridges, rocks, and the rocks are all slanted like this. And the side scan shows beautiful, absolutely beautiful records, but you have no idea what they are. We've had the divers down to several places, and they come up and say, there's rocks down there. And then they get discouraged, and we get, no, we don't get discouraged. We get mad.
Frustrated.
Yeah, frustrated. But sonar is a wonderful thing. When you go out on a ship, you don't see a thing. And then you put this wonderful thing in the water, and you go along, and out comes this beautiful thing with all the information about the bottom. But it doesn't have enough detail. It's just a sketch. Yeah.
Yes?
Titanic? Did I hear you say Titanic? About 3 months ago, I had a letter from somebody in New York. Says, we want you to help. We're going to make a movie of the Titanic. We will arrive in Boston April 1, we'll depart for Boston, for the Great Banks on April 2. We'll find the Titanic on April 6th. We'll have the pictures by April 15th. We'll return to Boston on April 23rd. That was a schedule. Did you say schedule up here or schedule? Anyway, it didn't go through because it's 12,000 feet deep. And it's my sonar won't go that deep. I don't think it'd be a good problem, but it's going to be a couple of weeks yet before that's finished. Well, I hope, yes. Well, I started taking pictures, and I thought underwater would be a good idea. So I got acquainted with, there was a professor from John Hopkins named E. Newton Harvey, who's the world's expert on these little fish that live miles deep and have little lights that hang over and glow lights on the sides. You ever read about those fish? And he wanted me to help him. So I built a strobe unit, and he took it to Bermuda and worked all summer. And he got a couple of dots on there, but he thinks they're fingerprints. So it was a complete failure. So I thought, this is great. So I helped to build a camera, another camera, and I wrote the Geographic magazine, and I said, I think you ought to sponsor some work all over the world of people that want to go down deep in the ocean, and you have to build equipment that will withstand these tremendous pressures. In the bottom of the deepest ocean, the pressures are 17,000 pounds per square inch. That's the same as if you took seven grand pianos and stack them all up and put them on one little piece of iron that square. Would they push through? And I thought it was impossible at first, but it's all done now. And they didn't. At first, I got a letter, a crackpot letter. They sent everybody, write some letters. And I got another letter through. And then I got a letter from Dr. Grosvenor himself, who said he was sending up some young Frenchman who would like to talk to me. And I never heard of Cousteau. And he arrived in Boston. I went over to the train to meet him. In those days, we traveled in trains. This was in 52, I think it was. And he stayed all night at my house. We talked. First of all, he hadn't been in my house more than, or in my lab more than 10 minutes. And I found out he'd invented this tank you put on your back. And I just bought one, so I put it right on him and rushed him right over to the pool and used him as my test diver in my MIT pool, swimming with this camera. And we worked out a whole bunch of projects. We haven't finished them all yet, things to do in the ocean. So I've known him, I've been on his ship I don't know how many times. But he's a very, very interesting man. He's got lots of steam.
I can't quite hear.
Did you hear the rings in the bottom of Loch Ness?
Yeah.
Can you tell what the historic period is?
No. There was supposed to be an expedition this week, but it was canceled until spring. No one knows.
They have no idea whatsoever.
Well, you see, I'm not an expert in this field, and we've got University of Edinburgh people working on it, and we're giving them all the information we can, and we've got a few photographs, but that end of the lake is very cloudy, so the pictures are very poor. And I think some of those stones are going to be actually covered with mud. We may have to excavate them. So it's a good research project. We don't know about it, but there's lots and lots of circles there. And I'm sure those were made by men. And I'm sure they weren't made while the water was in the lake. So the lake has risen, probably due to some earthquake or catastrophe at some time. Maybe 1,000, 2,000, 3,000 years ago. But most of those circles, I think, go back, well, I shouldn't say because I really don't know. But they're very ancient, very ancient. Well, I think we've worn this audience out, haven't we?
I think so.
Thank you very much for your attention. Thanks for your help. I got a souvenir for you.
I'm going to ask Professor Finn if he'll express the thanks of the meeting to our guest speaker.
It's just about 80 years ago that Louis Boultin took the first underwater photographs with a 400-pound camera. Unfortunately, Louis didn't have a strobe light, so he had to expose his film for 30 minutes. Professor Edgerton brought the world of underwater photography alive for us tonight in a very unique way and with a magnificent collection of pictures. In the process, I think he also refurbished the professorial image a little bit. I personally found it very reassuring to find out that professors do clever and useful things and can describe them with flair and humor. Those of us who collect our impressions of professors from page 6 of the Vancouver Sun would never think we had those qualities. I was very relieved that Professor Edgerton did not, in fact, find the Loch Ness Monster. We Celts would hate to have our myths degenerate to reality. After a performance such as Professor Edgerton put on, and I would have to call it a performance, a formal vote of thanks, in my opinion, is not only pretentious but totally inadequate. I haven't seen such droll humor since I caught the last Jack Benny show. So on behalf of us all, Professor Edgerton, I want to assure you of something that I'm sure you already feel yourself, that we've had a wonderful evening, we loved having you, and we hope to see you again.
I'm sure you must realize that I'm not a scientist. May I just remind you, ladies and gentlemen, of our speaker next week at the Vancouver Institute will be Mr. Harry Swartz, who is a member of the South African Parliament for the Progressive Reform Party. I'm sure his speech will be very provocative. He advocates the elimination of apartheid laws, and he advocates a dramatic improvement in race relations. He's coming here as a Dal Grauer Memorial Lecturer, and in addition to his speech to us next Saturday night, he will also speak twice more at the university on Tuesday, October the 12th at 8:15 p.m. in the Totem Park residence, and in room 106 in the Buchanan Building on Thursday, October the 14th at 12:30, and then finally next Saturday night at our meeting. Thank you. Meeting is now adjourned. Thank you.